cross-section measurements and his three-dimensional measurements. And I think right now we're not on the same page on that one. And I think the easiest way to get back on the same page with that one is to actually make an H-field dimension measurement. So in other words, if you have a radiating source where you have a dependable reading that you like, and then move it away from that source and follow the fall-off, and then compare that to a resonant antenna and move it away and see what the difference is. And I think you'll start to understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I'll admit that when you use a sensing antenna, like that cage dipole, and you try to make a measurement a very short distance away, the cage dipole is disturbing the living daylights out of the environment, and you're going to get some crazy readings unless you do a bunch of correction factors. Glenn, you and I are having two different ways of looking at a document. People listening to our conversation could misinterpreting that you and I are arguing with each other. I think we're not. We've got two different ways of looking at a phenomenon. It isn't that one of us is right and one of us is wrong. And I'm going to have to go back and read C95 some more, because I might very well have a misinterpretation. I'll admit that the amount of measurements I've made below a megacycle is zero. You've been there below a megacycle by way of your power supplies. I have not. By way of the near-field measurements of a transformer where an E-field falls off and an inductor and an inverter, it falls off by a cube law. I'm agreeing with you on that one. And you've then said that when we go to a planar field, infra field, of a intentionally radiated wave from a transmitter, which is very different than the close-up measurements of a power supply, I think there could be a difference in the way Mother Nature behaves. But until I read some more of C95, I'm not sure. Hope I haven't made you unhappy with what we said to each other so far tonight. I think we're still friends. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
No, Dick, it's these discussions. You know, if I had a blackboard half the time, and this is very hard to do over the air. And there's things that I have here, even in my shack, documents and other things where I could show these things. I don't have them. I it's not like I can just put a PDF in a blackboard, just point to things. it's frustrating on my part, is really what it is. But what's really happening is that when you're measuring H fields, the types of sensors and detectors where you can really measure up close are easy to make and manufacture. When you start getting a way to get any kind of gain out of them, they become useless. So what happens is that the full measurement device becomes an antenna, and the antenna has gain as well. So you have gain, polarization, and you can basically point at a source. But now you have to get back to what is the measurement that you're making. So because the E and the H field are in the cross-section at that period of time, you have to go with the properties of the antenna. So the establishment of E and H in that antenna are what's dominant, and that's what's used, and that's what's in the standard. So that's why all of those things look that way. But what happens is if you're using a pure H sensor, and it's not an antenna, just a real H sensor, and you're looking off of a source, and you start moving it away, and it's calibrated, and you start looking at that fall off of what's really happening in free space, you'll without the direct E field, you get a much better understanding. But I think you really need to make that measurement first, and then you'll see what we're talking about. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
On a slightly more pleasant subject, you probably have seen the YouTube video that Wes recommended we look at, where you see these three little objects of about 1 centimeter square each above a neodymium magnet, and I think they are anti-magnetic. They're one of these devices, and I don't know whether or not cryogenics was involved, but these things were floating above a magnet. I wonder if you saw that video. I wonder if you've got an explanation for what's going on there, Glenn. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
No crazy at all. No, Dick, unfortunately, I haven't had the time to look at that one, but it's something I'll definitely be looking for in the future.
Okay. John, you've seen that one also. Wasn't it interesting the way they floated about over 16th of an inch or so above the magnet, KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Absolutely, Dick. I know they're very thin and they're very light, but they were definitely floating. Cryogenics, Wesley says no, and it seems to be graphite base, the bottom piece. I don't know what those little square centimeter objects are, whether they're steel or any particular type of metal, but yeah, I found that extremely interesting. I'd really like to know what's going on there.
I think you're saying your impression was that the bottom object was not a magnet. I thought the bottom object was a series of cube magnets all put together. There was about 4 or 16 of those cubes, and I could tell by the way they were stuck together and why the devices that were floating would only float in very specific locations, right at the lines of edge of those magnets. So I'm almost positive the objects on the table that they were floating above were magnets. Did you get a different impression of that one, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Well, it's not ferromagnetic material, so I don't know what kind of magnets it could be, unless there's a magnet underneath it. I have no idea what was going on there. Maybe Wesley has more information on what it actually is, in brevity, I hope.
I'm pretty sure they were floating above magnets. Did you see it that way, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW?
Yeah, N2XJN. Y-R-O-L-Y-T-I, catalytic graphite. This is a ferromagnetic material. It's flowing over the neodymium magnet. We were talking about levitating the log, which is actually the water, the probe, but it's actually the water. But this thing is a physical body. It does have a certain mass, and it is diamagnetic. And it's flowing over the magnet. The polarity of graphite material is going onto the substrate, like that. It's a layer of composition which has a different properties in different planes. So in the C plane, which would be the vertical, across its layers, it has a low thermal conductivity, acting as an insulator. In the AB plan, which will be the horizontal A and B, the length and the width of it, it has a very thermal conductivity, acting as an excellent conductor. And the applications usually are the heat sinks, rocket nozzles, heating elements, sputtering targets, ion implementation components, orientation of components, electron beam melting crucibles, and ferrolithic graphite CVD coatings.
Do you believe any cryogenics was involved? It looked like nothing was being cryogenically cooled. It looked like a series of cubic magnets, which I think are neodymium type, a whole group of them were laying on the table, and these three floating devices above didn't look like they're cryogenically cooled. I think I saw the guy moving them with his finger, but I'm not sure. Maybe he was doing it with tweezers. But I don't remember seeing cold air coming off them like they had been cryogenically cooled. And if so, that's kind of exciting that something would float in the air without cryogenics. And without cryogenics, you don't get superconductivity. So something else is going on. To your knowledge, is there an explanation for how the levitation was taking place if there was no cryogenics involved? Over to US, K2LIW.
100% no cryogenic at all. And the reason that I brought it to your attention is because I wanted both of you, if Glenn is aside and you would tell me something that I do not know, and which is the molecular structure mechanism that is ruling that. give you a few information about this. Mostly, when you take a periodic carbon, as matter by itself, it is graphite. And it has a covalent bonding between the graphene sheet as a result of imperfection in this production. It's chipping like a mica. So, periodic carbon is man-made and not found in nature. It doesn't exist in nature. But generally, it's produced by heating a hydrocarbon, merely the decomposition temperature permitting the graphite to crystallize. Thank you. So, one of the methods is to heat synthetic fibers in the vacuum. Another method would be to place the sheet or the plate in very hot gas and call it graphite coating. That's what some company does commercially over it. Now, how the metallization is being done? The two materials can be made by magnetically levitate above the magnetic field from the permanent magnet. Although the permanent magnetic repulsion is obviously and can be achievable between two magnets for the shape of their field, it causes one to push the other of the sideways rather than supporting it above each other. When you look at the movement of the sheets, it looks like they tend to go to the cross section between the magnets. Let's see that.
KC2QAQ with a brainstorm.
Beautiful. Go ahead, please. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I just thought of something while I was downstairs. I had a brainstorm. I was just listening. And, yeah, here's what I came up with. 377 in free space is a cross-section. And how do I definitely stand on solid ground on this one? A resistor can only have two positions to it. It has one side, a left side and a right side, per se. And a current can only flow in it in one direction. It can flow one direction or the other direction. Thus, we can create a square. So, in other words, you can have an AC signal in a resistor, but you can't have a cube in a resistor, because even a three-phase signal can only happen at different frequencies, but not at a single frequency. So it's obviously, when we're talking about 377 in free space, we're talking about a square. When we talk about the dimension of the free wave in the electromagnetic wave in free space, we have the three dimensions because they're not at the same position. They're at right angles in space. So it truly is three-dimensional. I hope that clears up things a little bit more. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I've seen resistors that a simple linear device, like an RCO7 carbon composition resistor, is primarily linear. I've worked with scrim material, which is a sheet of resistive material, which has ohms per square. And you can buy material that's 377 ohms per square. And there's volumetric resistive materials like seawater. Seawater is a volumetric material of 0.2 ohm meter. So you could have, in the case of a volumetric resistive material like seawater, I could, if I want to, put a certain E field between the left-hand wall and the right-hand wall of a cube. I could put another E field between the top wall and the bottom wall, and I could put a third E field between the front wall and the back wall. Oh, and if they mix together in the middle in a complicated manner, which would be a tensor. There would be a tensor of E field versus position across that cube. But I could put three separate E fields, all mutually perpendicular to each other, across a volumetric material. Now, is free space of 377 ohms linear, planar, or volumetric? I don't know. You're going to tell me. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
The above, Dick. All of the above. But what's interesting, the part about that is that when we talk about 377, we're always handling it as the cross-section, as the square, because we're looking at it in one plane. Now, what's happening is if you were to take your volumetric material and apply
apply a voltage across it in any one direction, the potential will always fall off by a certain ratio. The current ratio will not be the same. That's really where it comes from, with the three-dimensional material. K2RIW, K2RIW.
If I was measuring the resistivity of seawater, and I've got a 1 meter cube of seawater in a plastic tank, and the left-hand wall is a sheet of metal, the right-hand wall is a sheet of metal, I put my ohm meter between the two, and I measure 0.2 ohm, and I confirm that it has a resistivity of 0.2 ohm meters, and it also has a conductivity of I think the number is 5 siemens. Yeah, I think it's 5 siemens. While I'm putting that voltage between the left-hand sheet and the right-hand sheet, I could then go anywhere in that cubic meter of water. I could take any one of the 1 cubic centimeters of water near the left-hand sheet, near the right-hand sheet, in the BM geometric center, top, bottom, wherever. I believe I will measure the exact same number of volts per centimeter of E-fields across any one of those cubic 1 centimeters, and there's a million of them in that 1 cubic meter. I've got a thoroughly linear, constant E-field across that seawater. That's my belief there, Glenn. Hoping you, K2RIW.
Precisely, you're right on the money. But now look at the current distribution across the volume. That's what makes it so interesting, is that the current distribution is not linear to the voltage. That's what's wild. When you look at current in three dimensions, you have a distribution, and where the voltage follows a linear distribution, the current distribution, because of the volume, is no longer following the same rate, if you follow what I'm saying, because current in its unit, I'm just trying to I'm running a little brain dead right now. Its distribution in a volume is different than the distribution of voltage. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
We've already agreed, Glenn, that each one of the 1 million cubic centimeters in this 1 cubic meter of seawater has the exact same number of volts per centimeter across each one of them. All 1 million cubic centimeters have the exact same number of volts per centimeter. And each one of those cubic centimeters of seawater have the exact same resistivity. Doesn't that mean that the current flowing through every one of those cubic centimeters of water is the exact same current? If they've all got the same resistivity and they've all got the same voltage, don't they all have the exact same current? Isn't that a thoroughly linear current everywhere in that 1 cubic meter tank of seawater? Over to you, Glenn. K2RIW.
Right on. In every cross-section of cut, you're absolutely correct. But now, how many current paths do you have in three dimensions?
I'll admit there's an infinite number of current paths, depending on how I want to define them. I could make each current path a 1 centimeter column from left side to right side, 1 meter in length, 1 centimeter cross section. I could look at those individual current paths. I could break them up into 4 centimeter square columns. In other words, there's an infinite number of ways, but the current density, I think I would measure current density in that case of amps per square centimeter. Yes, I could measure the current density in units of amps per square centimeter, and no matter where I probe, no matter which one of the square centimeters I use, cubic centimeters I use as a test, I think I'm going to come up with the exact same number of amps per square centimeter anywhere in that particular tank. Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
That's precisely correct. In any one square measurement, you'll get exactly that. But now do a three-dimensional distribution of the current. As you go from one side to the other, the current distribution is going to be different from as you go across from length to length. So as you go in three dimensions, what's happening is the current becomes cubed and the voltage becomes squared. That's what the difference is.
Okay, step by step now. Each individual square, each individual cubic centimeter has got the exact same number of volts per centimeter across them. Each individual cubic centimeter has the exact same number of amps per square centimeter flowing through that cubic centimeter. Whether I choose one top, bottom, left, right, center, wherever, they're all the same. That sounds to me like a linear relationship. In other words, if I take my volt-ohm-milliammeter, my digital voltmeter, and I connect the black lead to the left-hand plate, and I take the red lead and I dip it into the seawater, and assume now that my voltmeter has got infinite impedance, so it's not loading the system. I dip it into the seawater in the top of the tank, the top surface is open, this cubic meter of seawater, and I slowly sweep the red lead from the left-hand plate where I measure 0 volts toward the right-hand plate. Assume I put 10 volts across the tank. As I slowly sweep that red lead touching the seawater, I will, in a linear manner, see the voltmeter go between 0 and 10 volts as if I was sweeping the arm of a potentiometer. That sounds linear. Where am I wrong on that one, Glenn? K2LIW?
You're not. Your measurements are still square. You have to think three-dimension now. So what I'm doing is I'm going to bring you to the cube root. Take your box of seawater and fold it in a metal box. So all sides of this metal box are going to be surrounded by, we'll call it ground. Okay, that's the negative side, the whole box. Now you're going to put a probe. You're going to drop a battery in the middle of this thing, and you're going to attach a wire with a very, very low resistance to that outside of the outside box, so that the outside box now is negative. And the little voltage probe that's in the middle of this water now is hanging off the top of this battery. And let's say it's a waterproof battery in the middle of this water. And now measure the current distribution across from the center probe in the center of the tank to each wall as it goes on the outside in three dimensions. The current distribution is going to have three dimensions now, where the voltage fixed across it is fixed by the battery to the outside. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
See, I think I'm in agreement. If all six sides of the box are metallic and conductive, and I've got my perfect seawater in there, and if in a tiny little hole in the top, I drop an insulated wire, and at the end of the insulated wire, I've got a small, round, metallic bulb. And to that small metallic bulb in the geometric center of this cube of seawater, I connect my 10-volt battery, the positive lead. The negative lead I connect to the metal of the box. I'll admit now that I've got a very complicated voltage distribution and current distribution in that seawater, where the E-field gradient is largest near the little round bulb that has the voltage. The E-field in volts per meter, volts per centimeter, is going to be maximum right at the bulb. It's going to be minimum at the walls of the box, really minimum in the eight corners of the box. So I've got a very complicated E-field in that three-dimensional situation where I've got a point source of voltage in the geometric center of this cube, and the outside is grounded. Yes, that's a very complicated system. I don't think a electromagnetic wave in the planar far field has that distribution. Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
Study that field, and then what you do is now replace the battery with an AC generator and watch the distribution of voltage and current in three dimensions inside that resistivity of three dimensions, and you've got your EH field, EI field for an electromagnetic wave in free space, Vic. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Inside of the reactive near field of the antenna, I'm going to agree. In the far field where the wave is thoroughly planar, the wave front is thoroughly planar, and the E is, in theory, thoroughly vertical, and the H is thoroughly horizontal, in that environment, I believe everything is linear. That's the reason why the antenna people will say that in the far field, the E falls off linearly with this distance. The antenna people have said that many times, in the far field, planar wave, that's the way that it behaves. I wonder if we're in agreement on that one, Glenn. K2LIW?
Sure are. And we just got to the Holy Grail. What's happening is with an antenna is always looking at a cross-section because it's in free space, but it's looking at a cross-section. And because of the tuned impedance of the antenna, it always has to be a square. It always has to be in square. It's not a three-dimensional device. So the E-field that's sensed around the resonant length of the antenna is always going to have to be square to the current that's flowing through the antenna. So that is the way an antenna works. But if you look at the distribution in free space, the current is obviously taking a different distribution in free space than it would be in a cross-section of an antenna. So the antenna people are right, and the local measurement people are right. Everybody's right. They're just all different measurements. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Every real antenna has an effective capture area, which can be quantified in square meters. A dipole happens to have an effective capture area that, if your eye could see it, is not a square. It's elliptical. It's an elliptical-shaped area. In the case of an 80-meter dipole, that ellipse does have an area of 8,500 square feet. I happen to live in the English system of units. So it has a known area, which is not necessarily a square. Yet that dipole, in a very predictable manner, picks up a known number of volts per meter, a known number of watts per square meter, a known number of amps per meter, and responds in a predictable manner. So the antenna doesn't have to be square. Yes, some horns are, the effective capture area of some horns are, but a general antenna can have an effective capture area of known number of square meters, but it can have almost any shape you want. I can take a thinned phased array antenna, and I can make its effector capture area be a whole bunch of dots in space, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
You're again absolutely correct, but that is a different subject. What I'm saying is the relationship to B to H is square in a resonant antenna. The pattern can obviously shift because there's a certain amount of directionality and patterns that come off of the antennas. So the shapes of the capture area away from the antenna can have different shapes, but the relationship of B to H at the antenna will always be in the direct proportion of B to H, which is going to be the square linear around whatever the reactive impedance of the antenna is. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
I'll admit the majority of antennas you and I use are resonant structures, traveling wave structures. However, I can build an antenna that is a phased array of 50-ohm resistors. One single 50-ohm resistor, a phased array of them. Yes, the 50-ohm resistor has a little bit of length to it. That's part of how it responds. If it was zero length, it would have no response. So there's a little bit of length to it, but I could make that length nearly infinitesimal compared to the wavelength I'm looking at. So I can make a thoroughly non-resonant antenna, broadband as all hell, out of 50 ohm resistors as a phased array. Yet I will still measure a predictable amount of E and H if you tell me what was the power flux density in watts per square meter of that far field planar wave coming at me. So I don't need resonance of the antenna. I'll admit that a non-resonant antenna is a hell of a lot less responsive for a whole bunch of reasons. But still, it doesn't have to be resonant. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Okay, so I have a short comment that will help with the censoring device. Because what I found is that the material that we were talking about, which is the paralytic carbon, has the relation to which you guys are talking about. The recent discovery in Japan shows that paralytic carbon can respond to laser light sufficiently, powerful natural sunlight by spinning or moving in the direction of the field gradient. It is flowing, showing the undergravity. The carbon magnetic susceptibility change up on the illumination, leading to unbalanced magnetization of the material, and there was a sideways force. So when we're talking about the wavelength, we're talking about this material to be used for the purpose of investigation of what you're talking about. Am I wrong, Dick?
Yes, can I just answer your first question?
Yeah, Glenn hasn't seen that YouTube video yet, so let's not go there right now, Wes. Glenn, last thing you and I talked about is a phased array of 50 ohm resistors, non-resonant. And although it's less efficient, what's your feeling as to what that will sense? Over to you, Glenn, KQLIW.
Yeah, obviously. Any E-field sensor that's cutting a cross-section will always measure B and H in the proportion of the square, just like as you pointed out before. If you took your water distribution and you put your voltage across it and you measure directly across it, you'll always measure E and I in that direct proportion. The same thing with your antenna, whether your antenna is resonant or not. It's just that what happens with the reason I always use the example of resonance is because the continuous wave in resonance gives you a very, very well-established voltage and current. But the antenna doesn't have to be in resonance to measure the square. Again, in other words, the square proportion between B and H, in other words, or the E and the H field. So in other words, it will always follow the proportion of the antenna in an area cross-section, because that's always what an E-field antenna is always measuring, is a cross-section. So resonance, yes, of course, gives you some reinforcement that helps to reestablish it over a continuous wave. But to have a non-resonant antenna, yes, it would do the same. It would still measure an area cross-section, because that's basically what antennas do. They measure, cross-sections. K2RW, KC2, QIQ.
I don't understand. Not necessarily true, Glenn. And let me show you what's going on here. There's a weird kind of antenna called an E-field probe antenna. It consists of a piece of wire sitting above a ground plane going into a FET transistor. A FET transistor. The vast majority, 99.9% of all the antennas the world uses, absorb energy from the environment. There's a whole class of antennas that are very rarely used. The FET E-field probe antenna absorbs no energy from the environment. It senses the local E-field of the signal that passes by. It absorbs no energy. Very similar to the comparison of a triplet model voltohm-milliohm meter with its 50 microampere movement, 20,000 ohms per volt. When you make a voltage measurement, it absorbs power from the environment. The power from the environment goes across the resistor, creates a current into the meter. It is the power from the environment that moves the meter needle, the Dawson-Val movement. But a modern-day digital voltmeter with its 10 megaohm input impedance measures the voltage of the environment. For all practical purposes, it absorbs no power from the environment. So that E-field probe antenna, I'm trying to think of the name of the damn thing. They are being used on stealthy aircraft. It absorbs no power. It has no effective cross-section, yet it measures the E-field directly. Are you familiar with that antenna, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LAW?
Yeah, that's just an extreme. In other words, just like the resonant antenna on one side in quarter wavelength is one extreme, that's the other extreme. In other words, what's happening there is where the current in the antenna is absolutely minimized. But as you said before, when you're sensing a voltage in a cross-section, in other words, or the voltage across a resistor, if the resistor's impedance is extremely high, you get the most accurate measurement of the voltage. And this is true with that antenna. It's just what's happening is to get the voltage measurement in the cross-section, what you're doing is you have a very, very high impedance of the resistor. And so whatever is in parallel with it, in other words, the 377 ohms of free space, you're getting the most accurate voltage measurement of the amplitude of that signal in free space. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, some of those FET transistors that they use on the E-field probe antenna have 10 to the 10 and 10 to the 12 ohms of input impedance. It's a more superior version than a digital voltmeter, which has a 10 mega ohm input impedance, simply because we set that as a standard. You and I could make a, I can't think of the name of the damn thing now. John's got one of these machines. You can have a kind of a voltmeter that's got 10 to the 10, 10 to the 12 ohms input impedance. It measures the E field between the two probes of the environment, draws no power from the environment. So I can make a pure E field sensing antenna. Those amplifier antenna things that I'm talking about, the FET transistor right in the front end, the gate of the FET transistor goes directly to a small piece of wire, and it measures. And by the way, that those things can have extremely broadband frequency response. The one that was in 73 magazine, 73 no, Ham Radio. The one that was in Ham Radio magazine had a rated performance from 1 megahertz to 1 gigahertz inclusive, flat across that frequency region. It had a little wire probe coming out of it that was about quarter inch or half inch long going into a FET transistor. So that is a pure E-field probe that has no square phenomena. It has no, it's a linear device measuring volts per meter and absorbs no power from the environment. I can come up with a similar device that measures each field without absorbing any power from the environment, therefore does not disturb the environment. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
I think that's the next step, Dick, is you have to build your H field measurement device and then start measuring H fields and then compare them to your E field antenna measurements and then come back and tell me what you see. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. I think Wesley out there is waiting with bated breath.
Yes, pure H field measurement, I'll admit, is not going to be easy. Although the Hall effect comes close. The Hall effect in its direction of sensing can be in the vicinity of a 16th of an inch thick. That's an extremely small fraction of a wavelength. If I set that thing up so that it's edgewise aimed toward the signal coming toward me, it is such an extremely small fraction of a wavelength. It is not disturbing the environment. It has no resonance. It might be low in sensitivity. I'm worried about that. But I think I can measure pure H field. I did that when I measured the steady-state Earth magnetic field. It came up with 450 milligauss in Farmingdale in 1972. I think it's been decreasing since then. I think it's now down to 300 and something milligauss. But, so, without disturbing the environment, I can measure pure H field. If there was a local E field near that gauss meter, I believe it would not respond to it. That's a pure H field sensing device. Am I violating any laws of physics when I do that? Because I'm not closing the magnetic path. The magnetic path of Earth is closed across a 25,000-mile circular path. I'm looking at 1/16th of an inch of that. And I made that measurement, and the measurement was far above threshold. I think the measurement was 30 decibels above threshold of that gauss meter. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Guys, hold on a moment. You're talking about the sensor. I'm giving you the perfect sensory, with and you keep to skipping it and then find it irrelevant. I don't understand it. Maybe I didn't say it properly. That material is spinning or moving in direction of the field gradient, which will be the pure H field by E field, by rejection of the H field, with no magnetic field involved. So you can have a tool, either that paralytic graphite that is over the magnet, or you have it without the magnet, but you use the radio wave. So why are you skipping that?
That paralytic material cannot respond at a 1 megahertz rate. I'm trying to measure the H field of a 1 megahertz radiated RF signal. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's not going to be an easy measurement, Dick. I still think it can be done. I know that there's equipment out there that will do it, but it probably cost the king's fortune. I think that if you probably were to even, you know, the thing is, how do we do this inexpensively to get you the real numbers that you're looking for? But I think if you probably were to use 1 megahertz as kind of a transmission source and then measure, you know, from that source and then
followed the fall off, and then were to measure the E field, I think you'll see the relationship pretty quick. It's you should be. I think that's a measurement you should be able to make, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
There are AM broadcast stations within a reasonable distance of my house, like WHLI, for instance, where I can drive close to them. They're radiating, let me pick a number, 10 kilowatts during the day. And do you have a gut feel that if I stood 1 mile away from that 1,000-foot-high tower of WHLI near the Northern State Parkway, if I stood 1 mile away, I know I could measure the volts per meter. It is my belief I can measure the amps per meter. Do you think I'm wrong on that one, Glenn? KQLIW?
I think the problem, Dick, is that it's going to be very difficult to get a sensor that's sensitive enough. I think that's going to be the real issue. But you're definitely the E-field sensor, no problem at all. To get a true H-field sensor to measure it, it's not going to be easy. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, the virtual assignment that you have just given me, then, is to do the following. Since I know the number of watts they're transmitting, and I know the amount of antenna gain they're using, I know the exact number of volts per meter at a mile, I know the exact number of amps per meter at a mile. Once I know those number of amps per meter at a mile, if I then go to the catalogs of H-field sensing devices that have a response at 1 megahertz, HLI I think is at 780 kilohertz, but something in that order. If I can find an H-field sensing probe that will respond to that number of amps per meter at 1 megahertz, then I think the problem has been eliminated. You're saying that I'm not going to be able to find that. Maybe you're right. So that's my assignment, to try to find an H-field probe at approximately 1 megahertz that will respond to that number of amps per meter. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, do two calculations. One is do your E field at inverse square, what you expect your H field to be at inverse square, and then do an H field divided by cube, inverse cube, and look at that number and see if you can find an H field detector that could determine the inverse cube. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Scott has recognized VE3ZTZ. I'm going to go to you in a minute, Scott. The antenna books say that the H field falls off linearly in volts per meter. You're saying it's going to fall off cube law. When I'm in the near field of a transformer, you're right. But the antenna people and the broadcast people say that the H field measured in amps per meter falls off linearly with distance. Are they wrong? Over you, Glenn, K2LAW.
No, they're correct when they're measuring with an antenna, an E-field sensor. When they measure with an E-field sensor, they're going, B and H are going to have to be at a square proportion. And that's always going to be exactly, it's a linear proportion, actually, between E and H in the antenna when you're measuring in a cross-section. But an antenna is not a true H-field sensor. So when you eliminate the E-field altogether, and there's no more E-field to create any more CW reestablishment in the antenna anymore, and you're just looking at pure H-field, it's going to fall off at inverse cube in free space. That's what the challenge is. That's why I think you're going to have a very difficult time trying to find a true H sensor that's going to give you those kinds of numbers. I think you to get a mile away, you might have to get within a few hundred feet. KC2QIQ.
I hear you, Glenn, and I've got my assignment. Scott, VE3ZTZ, wait for the three beeps, and what's your take on all this, Scott? You got it, Scott.
Just let me say I've been enjoying this for the last, all night. It's come up conversationally. You guys have gone into back and forth for a few minutes now, and this is why I love you guys. But I do have a question or perhaps a suggestion towards harmonizing the squared versus cubed in two different communities. Is this not a difference between a radiant measurement and
of a sphere versus the radiant measurement, which is the capture area of the outer edge of the curve. So in order to harmonize the two measurements, it's like you have a flashlight with a lens that projects the light. At the receiving point to collect the radiant information, you would have to have the reflector pointed back to the source, which focuses the beam down to a sensor. So there's a difference between the gradient and the radiant. Just wondering your thoughts on that word, EGZZ.
Yeah, by the way, Glenn and I are, to people who misunderstand this, you'll think that we're arguing and getting mad at each other. We're seeking a higher truth. And he comes from the heavy electromagnetic interference measurement world. I claim I come from the heavy antenna far field measurement world, where you're measuring patterns and gains and main lobe efficiencies and all that kind of jazz. So we come from slightly different worlds, and we're looking for the common ground of where our two worlds overlap. And I know there's an overlap there. We're eventually going to find it. Now, to my knowledge, when you're measuring radiance or radiance and so on, every real source, when you're far enough away from the source, could be considered a point source radiator, the real transmitter of the signal, whether it be a light signal or a radio signal or whatever. It's got some number of square meters of real area. But when you're far enough away, mathematically, you can consider it a point source. You can consider it an isotropic radiating point source. Let me drop it. And anything you're likely to use as the sensing device, the receiving device, has some amount of effective capture area. Almost all sensing devices suck energy out of the environment to make the measurement. Vast majority of the measurement devices. In the case of things that are trying to measure in a very broadband manner, watts per square meter, usually you have some kind of an absorber that gets hot in the process of absorbing, and you measure the microkelvins and the millikelvins of temperature increase when you're measuring small amounts of signal. But you're measuring watts per square meter. Some amount of area is the sensor in the vast majority of sensors, and the vast majority of sources can be considered a point source at a usually known distance. Now, there is a class of radio sensing devices, the so-called E-field probe antenna, with a FET amplifier right at the probe, and the probe itself is an infinitesimal wavelength. That's the one kind of measurement that can, in a pure manner, measure E-field without absorbing any energy from the environment, without disturbing the environment in any way. So whether you call it irradiance, and these are words used in the optical world, still, I think there's a real, what's the word I'm looking for now? Isotropic apparent radiated power, and there's a certain amount of effective area of the sensor. In almost all of these situations where you're trying to make a quantitative measurement of what was transmitted. Maybe there's another way of looking at it, but that's the way I see it, this guy. BE3ZTZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, the math for this goes back to my university days, which is once upon a time, and so it's, to call it rusty would be an understatement, but I did just Google an example of this to see if I could express the point a little better. And the example goes like this, and we are talking about light. So you have a light source, and you have a sensor, which is 50 millimeters by 50 millimeters in size, and it's in a flat plane. And you hold it 2 meters away, and it measures, let's say, 0.1 watts. The question then becomes, and that's because it's flat plane, that's a stradian. So what is the radian intensity? And the math then goes that it's 160 watts per stradian. And there's a formula that supports that. So it's the difference between the area, the inside area of a curvature at a distance versus a flat plane slice of that inside area of the curvature. And the antenna. antenna is always functioning in that flat plane slice, and there is always a difference from what I remember. Flawed as that may be. Loving the conversation, gentlemen, and I knew you two get along. It didn't appear that you were fighting. We all get that. So, thanks very much. V3ZZ back to net.
I just did an interesting calculation, Scott. To an antenna person, every emitting device has a reactive near field, and far field. Fraunhofer zone, Fresnel zone, and so on. 15 millimeters by 15 millimeters at the center of the optical band has a near field calculated range, 2d squared over lambda, of 409 meters. If you're not 409 meters from that particular source, assuming it was radiating in the middle of the optical band, 550 nanometers, if you're not 409 meters away or greater, it will not follow the normal inverse square law. Therefore, your method of measurement comes up with a different branch of mathematics. You're now in the Fresnel zone, and therefore it behaves in a different way. Does that make some sense, Scott? VE3ZTZ, K2RIW.
You're stimulating some very old brain cells, but yes.
So because you were inside, way inside of the reactive near field, you were not 409 meters away, almost half a kilometer away. That was a highly focused source from an antenna man's point of view. I could calculate what your beam width was out of that, and it's going to be some number of milliradians, whereas most of the antennas we RF people work with start off with a 10-degree beam width, not milliradians of beam width. So life gets very different when you're in the reactive near field. Now, there's a whole branch of mathematics of how you can take a great big phased array, and now with a very small probing device that's calibrated, you do a raster scan across that array in which you're measuring the magnitude of the signal being picked up by that probe, the phase angle of the signal being picked up by that probe in the near field as it does the raster scan. Let me drop.
Dick, can I ask a question after you're finished? K62QIQ.
You sure can. You then take that great big matrix of data I just described, go into a Fourier transform, and predict what the far field measurement will be. So in the real world of some antennas, where the near field is 3 miles, and you ain't got an anechoic chamber that's 3 miles long, not on the surface of Earth does that exist. So you make a near field measurement and project it to the far field. They do that, and you're getting close to that. Go ahead, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
I'm just going to ask this as kind of like a rhetorical question, and I know that you definitely look into physics a lot, you read into all this stuff, and I'm just going to, Mother Nature tends to work in a certain way, and it's very, Mother Nature's pretty darn stubborn, and when you look at all the calculations of antennas and how antennas are measured, and you hear discussions as near field, far field, and everything else, and in those discussions, relationships of amplitude over distance are changing. Now, your feeling of what you know about distance from near field to far field, it's taking on all new shapes? Is that the way Mother Nature works? Or do you think...
Okay, the machine has just turned off, Glenn, but I heard everything you said by way of the input, so don't worry, and I'll repeat those. And what you're really saying is, does the antenna pattern change? And the answer is a yes or no. That's one of the things you're sort of asking. When you make a measurement in the far field of an antenna, you're careful enough to make the measurement in the far field. And after you finish making that measurement, usually it's going to be a cardinal plane cut in the E plane or the H plane, and a whole bunch of other cuts, if you like, kind of cuts. You measure all of this antenna and eventually come up with a three-dimensional antenna pattern if you want. When you start off in the far field and measure what you think is the 3 dB beam width in D and the 3 dB beam width in H and the front to back ratio and the front side ratio, and then you make the measurement at twice the distance, you come up with the exact same antenna pattern, the exact same main lobe beam width in E
main lobe gain with an H, side lobe level, front to back ratio. The uniqueness about a far field measurement is that when properly done, the usual parameters you make from an antenna are independent of distance. However, you make a measurement of an antenna inside of the near field, you get an entirely different antenna pattern for each individual range. Unless you're doing this Fourier transform conversion that I just mentioned. I wonder if that makes some sense, Douglas. KC2QIQ, KULIW, I'll hear you on the input, don't worry. Very fine, Glenn. Believe it or not, we're making progress. I'm learning more about the EM electromagnetic interference world, and maybe you'll be exposed to some of the antenna world of parameters. And Scott, pretty sure when you come back, Scott, you'll be able to hear me. I'll be able to hear you, but unfortunately, I know you didn't hear everything Glenn said. Glenn signed off now. He's got to go to work tomorrow, as I do. Go ahead, Scott, if you want to have any further comments on all of that. B3ZTZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, B3ZTZ. No, we had copy on both of these. We're coming into the 9126 reflector, and I guess, well, whatever it is, holding both your repeaters. You are, however, down a little closer to the noise floor, so the copy is harder on you. As always, gentlemen, appreciate the net. I was just throwing some math dynamite into the pond there to help out with the squared versus not squared stuff. And not sure if it's completely relevant to your pursuit of the H field, but I thought I'd put it out there. Thanks as always, gentlemen. B3ZTZ.
Very fine. I know I'm kind of noisy here. Oh, I should have adjusted that to make it a little less noisy. Okay, you guys just heard technet number 1439 of the series that began in September of 1982. Assuming everybody is healthy next week, we'll all be back, and we'll try to understand a little bit more about what Mother Nature is telling us. Be kind to each other. Bye-bye for now. K-R-I-W, clear. Good night, John. Good night, John, boy. See you down the road. What was I going to say? Okay. Bye-bye for now.
We made another week. VE3ZTZ, VE3JIW. VE3ZTZ, VE3JIW. I'm here, or you are you?
For visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.